take it up to Norwalk, and I think had 25 cents left over. I stopped at an old friend, Baker, and bought a lemon pie, my favorite. I ate that pie on the road and walked 3 miles. I don't need that. Anyway, I'm not home. My dad said, well, glad to see you home. Mom, we go take care of your horses. Well, I felt pretty good. My stepmother, and she came over and put her arm over my shoulder and shook her head a little bit. My sister came up and hugged me. So I was home and glad to be there because I knew that I could have never made it in the city of Los Angeles or anywhere else. When I got in that trouble with those boys there, and what little I'd seen in the city, mind you, we'd been living within 20 miles of Los Angeles. I'd never been there for that time. Always, like most farm boys, wanted to get into the big city and see what it was like, you know. I got my stomach full of it. And I swore then I'd never live in Los Angeles, city of Los Angeles. I never did like big cities. After that, one I liked the best was San Diego and Salt Lake City, the larger cities. I always didn't mind small towns where everybody knew everybody else. And the mountains, the country, that was what I wanted, away from everything. Anyway, after I got home, I went back to my old work. Just picked up where I'd left off just a week before that. And I worked at planting the sugar beets and harvesting sugar beets till I was around 18, 19. My dad turned me. But I was a free man any time I wanted to. But it had come about that he was scolding me one time. Basically, I was around 17. I got to where I was beginning to talk back to him. You know, it started when at that time I went away from home. And I began to get a little nerve to talk back to my old dad. But this time he was scolding me pretty harsh. And he says, "The day you cannot work me, that's the day I'll turn you free." But it happened just before I took off on my own, either hauling some hay for a neighbor and setting it way up in a barn. And one side of it was clear. Half, we were filling half the barn. He wanted the other half clear. He was going to put something else in there, grain or something. And we were up about 30 feet. In those days, they used to make bales that weighed over 200 pounds, and that was a lot of heavy things to lift. And we had to step them up from stack to, roll them up, built steps out of the bales and then haul them up. The last ones were the hard ones to get up. And my father was on the edge, going up the edge with a 200-pound bale, and I was walking up far from him, flipping them over. We bring one end up, lean it on the other top of the bale, and then turn it over and lift. That was heavy lift. You lift with our hips and with our muscle, our weight. We threw our weight against the hooks to lift the bale up. There's a lot of tricks to it. And my father's foot slipped, and he started to go with the edge, a 220-pound bale was laying across him. And he only had a hold of one hook on the main stack. He was about ready to go over. Well, that frightened me. And I leaped over, set my bale down, leaped over, grabbed that 200-pound bale and lifted it right off of him and threw it up. Now, that was a lot of lift when a person who's either excited or frightened has a lot more power than most ordinary time. Now, my father straightened out, "Okay, son, a little old 200-pound bale knocks me down, you lift, toss it up like it was only 50 pounds, You outwork me now, you're free any time you want to go, wherever you want to go. Well, I reminded him of that sometime later, and not that I wanted to leave him, it's just that I did not want to farm sugar beets anymore. We were in debt. We had to buy, every year we had to buy new tools and new implements and new things coming out. We were working for the sugar factory and for the landowners. They got a quarter of whatever we raised, whatever was produced. The sugar factory, they would not let us use our own money if we had any to buy seed, to pay for the sinners, to pay for the hoers and the toppers. We had to borrow the money from them, or they gave us the seeds, and they charged us for it. We started in November. They charged us interest on whatever money we got from November to November. Now, mind you, we would get, say, $200-$300 in the month of March, April. They still charged us from no interest from November to November. And this I kept telling my father, this is not right. We're the slaves to the sugar factory. Well, he agreed with it. And I told him, if you want to farm hay, farm beans, anything else, except sugar beets, I'll stay with you. Yeah, he says, all our equipment you have is for sugar beets. He started to get rid of things. He kept a few horses, young colts, cows, pigs, chickens, goats, and dogs, cats, geese, turkeys, my stepmother. Kept those things, and I, there was two brothers, they were quitting, and on from the same ranch, quitting sugar beets, and they went into Los Angeles to deliver a big beet wagon that we used to belong to some friends of theirs. And I went with them. They were going to Imperial Valley. We left the wagon there and we hooked onto a spring wagon with three little mules. Every noon we'd change mules. We started out of Los Angeles on a Sunday. We got to Calexico on a Sunday, 7 days. On the way, we tried to go into the army camp where my brother was. We wanted to see him before he left for Europe. They wouldn't let us in the way we went. We'd have to go around only about 10, 15 miles to get around. In San Diego, we stopped to have the wheels, the rims tightened on the wheels, and we took off. I was a hunter and a cook.
What year did you take?
This was 1917. I was 19. Not quite. Yeah, all of these turned 19. And I had a cousin in Calexico. And so I stopped with him. Well, he immediately got me a job. I got there on a Sunday. Monday, I went to work across the border. Now, mind you, I had no papers of any kind, no identification papers. The only thing that I could spoke good English, and I had no reason to worry about it. During the war, they were pretty strict at the border. I went to work weighing cotton in the cotton ranch for Colston Williams farm. Cotton was the big thing in Imperial Valley at the time, both sides of the border, and the government there was new, Northern Lower California. Cantu was the governor. He was a military man. He just crossed the river and took over. Now, the local people, they were glad to have somebody there, and he started moving to improve things. He started bringing in the Chinamen, $10 or $300 each, and then $10 a month. The big tongs in San Francisco were loaning money to these Chinese for bringing them in, and they were renting land from the Lower California government in Cantu. So much an acre. There were thousands and thousands of acres with huge mesquite groves and huge giant trees. That was rich soil.
When you say Lower California, I'm a little confused. Is that past the Mexican border or?
Blimey. That's lower California. We have no lower. We have Southern California, but no Lower California. And that's, we have Northern Lower California and Southern Lower California. That's the way the Spanish named it. Anyway, I worked there quite a while, and about that year was when I started on the pile driving, on the construction work. And this is something that I really love to do. I like to create, not, you know, build things. And I had just a gift for building things. I knew enough of figures to learn to read, that where I learned to read blueprints, and I made it all right up until I retired. When I was 66, I retired here. But I followed that game from 1917 to 1927, and I quit in San Pedro. That's when I went back home to take care of my old dad. Then the Depression hit. I think I've spoken on that before on another tape, where he told me about, to save my money, what the people were going to be crossing the streets to looking for a piece of bread. And this all did happen. It happened to me. And that's when he told me, I asked him, well, what shall I do in case this? Follow the farmers. Go to the farming country. When the farmer becomes hungry, the professionals starve to death. Well, sure, around the farm there's all kinds of food. A lot of things for them. They have chicken there. When did you go there and go to work for farmers? Say, I'll work all day, give me two chickens. You know, you don't have to go hungry. And I didn't, except when I was roaming around traveling. I did go hungry. I'd move from one place to another. When I went back, there was no, I'd have to wait around for a job. Sometimes I would both. I did go pretty darn hungry one time, enough to pass out on a job. I hadn't eaten for 4 days. And I pulled out of that all right. That was the only time. I remembered something else that my father used to tell me. If a dog, a human, a dog, a cat, a horse, any animal comes, or a human comes to your house and asks you for something to eat, feed them. He says, a hungry human being is dangerous. An animal? Well, they're God's creatures too. You feed a hungry man or a hungry animal, and you'll never go hungry yourself. Don't ever refuse anybody, nobody who your worst enemy, don't refuse them a meal. Well, I remember having done that with a man after I got working, and I was driving piles, well, things would go right for me. There was a man in town that, he was really no good. He wouldn't work. He was always watching around to who he could gyp, or we'd hear hearsay that he'd knock a drunk in the jaw and take his money for him. But he was in partnership with some police there. And he'd get in a fight with an Anglo, an American, who was gone across the border to have a little fun, do a little drinking and what have you. And this guy would get in a fight with him, and then the police would come along, his buddy would come along and arrest both of them. They'd turn him loose, from the American, not less than $20. And whatever there was left over, they'd share it. But anyway, this man was really hungry and sick. Well, I took care of him and fed him. And then sometime later, I went out, went to work, came home, stayed with my dad for a while, went back again. And things went bad for me. I got sick and went hungry, was going hungry, not too hungry. I had some friends here and there, but once in a while I wouldn't see a friend for a day. So I'd miss maybe two meals. I met this fellow. He was well dressed, and he was gambling in the aisle, a big gambling house there. And when he walked away from the table, I asked him if he'd let me have a couple of dollars. And he looked at me up and down. He said, I'm not putting out any money for anybody. I said, but buddy, don't you remember? I said, I'm really in trouble. I picked you out of trouble. I fed you for a week or two. I said, took care of medicines and what have you. I even rented a room for you when you were sleeping in the cotton seed. Well, sis, Okay, so you spent the money on me, so don't be a damn fool next time. I said, all right. That's it. Shortly after that.
Where was the owl?
Huh?
Where was the owl?
In Mexicali, across the border. There was no gambling on this side, no liquor on this side. All the things on that side, Tijuana and Mexicali. And the gambling was paying big taxes. And that was helping. That and the Chinese coming in was keeping that, getting that government going. Come to when he had to, when he was pushed out by the federal government, the regular government, you know, he was just in there. He'd taken over, that's all. When he left $17 million in American money, gold there. Within 2 weeks, there was no money left. He was an honest man, a good man. He built a highway from Mexicali to Ensenada and Tijuana. Before that, it was just trails up very steep mountains, a very rugged mountain there. And he was dealing with in Mexico, where trucks on down to the Gulf where they'd transship loads from cotton from Mexicali or the valley down to ships, and there they'd pick up other things for them. Doing something good. But anyway, he left. He had a lot of backers that wanted him to fight to stop him. There was 1,250 Yaquis and 250 Sonorenses or National Guardsmen that coming out of Sonora. Colonel Rodriguez was the man who was in charge. He crossed the river. Cantu, no, he decided in a speech that he made to the public that he was going to leave. He did not want to spill no blood. There was no need for it. But he would leave. He did speak there. I heard him. I was listening. He had left $17,000 in American gold. Now, just before that, I had joined the volunteer there with the truck drivers. And all I had to do was an assistant, carry a gun. The only duties I had we had to sleep on the truck, the truck driver and the helper had to sleep on the truck. I was there 3 days, and I began to think, now why? Supposedly they do go to war. There were several days there they were negotiating back and forth, you know, talking. And the troops that were coming in were at the river, the Colorado River. The fact of the matter is that their paymaster was, I don't know how many thousand pesos, in crossing the river on a raft. Raft turned over, and he and all the money went down, and couldn't get him. There was a lot of water in that river then. That was the only casualty of that. There was supposed to, everybody was excited there was going to be a war, and there was a lot of volunteers, the youngsters, and some of the friends I'd made there. They talked me into it. And I began to think, I have no business here. I don't belong in this country. They've done nothing wrong to me. Well, they had tried a couple of individuals. And so I had to thinking, besides, I don't want to stop no bullets. I got to thinking about that. Mine's a pretty big target, you know. And there's bullets flying all around. If there's one you're going to hit it, it's already got your name on it. Well, I decided I quit. They paid me off $3 a day for 3 days, and I turned over the gun I was carrying on my hip, turned it over to the friend that had loaned it to me, and I waited to see what happened. Oh, I got a job. There was an American company putting up a building for the Chinaman, the Chinese businessman, and got a job with the plumbers. When the troops came in, marching in, they came in at 5 o'clock in the morning, about a week after I had quit and turned in my gun. They came, I heard a little drum, and it's kind of an odd little sound. I heard it off at a distance, and I wondered. I had to get up early to go wet some concrete where I was working, wet it down, some new concrete. And so I'd get up about 5 o'clock. I'd make my own breakfast with the landlady where I was boarding. And I'd start off at 6 o'clock. I was supposed to go be on the job. Well, I heard this little drum way off about a mile away. Nobody knew anything. About 5:30 in the morning. Now, it starts off when they're marching. It's their marching drum and their war drum. It goes boom, 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 boom. That's all it is. It's a little drum with a handle. It's about 18 inches in diameter, about 4 inches wide. Got a drum head on both sides. And the man goes along with his little handle. He goes beating that thing. And I asked some questions about it. And they, when they went into war with other Indians or with the Mexican government, they'd start off at a man's heartbeat, the drum. It may be one or two protecting the drummer. But he'd march along and go in to face the enemy. And as they went into battle, the beat got faster and faster and faster and faster to excite the men. Their heartbeat as it went up by the drum. And I've been wanting to get the drum heads or the hides to make one. Make a little for these Indian pistols. A Yaqui war drum. Which is a plain little drum, no feather, no nothing on it. But I would decorate it, you know. For instance, one of the animals that they worshipped on as the Yaquis used to. Didn't, I don't know whether they worship or not, but anyway, is the jaguar. And the eagle, of course. The wolf. In fact, the Aztecs, they had different societies. The Eagle Society, the Jaguar Society, the Lion Society, and the Wolf Society. Those are different societies than the Aztec ruling people. And so I've studied and read. So, anyway, we're still in Mexicali. At about this time was when I first got into trouble there. No, it was after that. I got kind of mixed up. The boys, my friends over there, I'd made a lot of friends. Some, because of my broken Spanish, or California Spanish, which was something really terrible. When I look back at it, and the pronunciation of certain Mexican words or Spanish words, and how we mixed them up. In fact, there was some English attached, added to it. Ice cream was ice cream, and my brother would tell me, go to the pasture and get the caballo and put him on the buggy and we go to town and get some provisiones. That was our Spanish mixture with English, and my father used to scold us. Either speak Spanish or speak English, one of the two. That mixture, he'd bawl it out once in a while. But anyway, some of the people over there would criticize me, and actually some of them insulted me because of my broken Spanish, so I got to where I wouldn't talk. But some, especially the people where I was boarding, there was a little 14-year-old girl there that used to treat me like a brother, and she would correct me. She was well-educated, and she was going, a girl, or boy or girl, 14 over there, is going to, they're about finished with high school here, the equivalent to high school, and they really teach them over there. They used to anyway, I don't know about now, but anyway, I was beginning to learn, and this girl told me I could read and write Spanish. She'd give me some books, you know, looks like these, just stories, fiction in Spanish, so I could read and learn to produce. And the words that I didn't quite understand, well, I'd ask her. But you take a lot of the words in English, big words, but one word maybe you put down one word here, it'll take care of almost half a what would you call it? I don't know. But anyway, I find that a lot of American or English words almost sound the same in Spanish, and they mean the same. Combination, combinación. That's just one example. But anyway, I began to learn Spanish, better Spanish. In fact, since then, I've had to speak. I got mixed in politics there. They wanted me to distribute. I told them I don't belong here. I can't vote. Well, you can work for us anyway. There was an election coming on. And they were hot elections over there. I was distributing pamphlets and papers and going to meetings and listening to them talk. One day, just before the elections, one of the great speakers, he'd been pretty radical, I found him dead in an alley with a knife in his back, still sticking in his back. Oh, I went and called a policeman. He came over, and darn, the policeman was all about ready to put me in jail. And I argued with him. I was just going by. I work over here.
Do you remember the name of the man that was stabbed?
No. No, I don't remember that, his name. And if I did, I wouldn't say it here, because he might have a relation, you know. He might read or hear or something. You never know. Of course, this was a long time ago. A good long time ago. Well, 3 days later, I found another one. Or rather, I didn't find him. He was laying in a gutter. He was laying on his back, and he'd been stabbed in the chest, right through the heart. Men who were very radical and were on the opposition, I said, the heck with this, I'm getting out of here. I don't want no part of politics here. So I came home, and that was the end of my stay there, excepting, well, I went back, and I got a job in the ABC Brewery, the Aztec Brewing Company. Well, one time, the watchman, I worked daytimes, I had already dressed, changed clothes, and I had a date to go eat with the family, have dinner with the family, friends of the lady that I was boarding, where I was boarding. Her name was Pilar Flores. Never forget her. And that little girl who used to help me out was Angelina. And she had a brother, Juanito, or Johnny. Everybody called him Johnny. John, just like me. Anyway, a man and five young boys. I've known these boys. Now, this is 19, maybe many years later. This is 1927. Wait a minute. No, not 27. What was it? 26. I was working this brewery. I'd been working there 6 months. I helped build it. Then I went down to the Gulf to do some fishing with a fishing outfit that didn't pay off. On the way down to the Gulf, there were no roads then. Every driver that went that way made his own roads. I was riding with two Chinamen going to go over to pick up some fish, and I saw something I just heard about. Something flashed in the lights, and then they came again from the same direction. They crossed the lights, and the Chinaman stopped, the driver. And I counted 42 antelope. And that's about the last of the herd is in those places. There used to be, according to my father, there were thousands of them in Sonora, out in those deserts, mm-hmm. And mule deer, desert mule deer. And now there's no more, I guess, no more. There might be mule deer out in the Sonora desert. I know there's deer in Lower California, and the natives there call them the little deer, the antelope. And they were small, kind of scrawny, not big like our antelope here in the plains. Mm-hmm. They're very large. They're large. Well, these were just still about as high as this table, I guess, about 30 inches tall, with the forked horns, and the color is all the same. And they're a very curious animal. When they crossed in front of us the first time, stopped for a little bit, and then run across, and went in a circle, came back again, and stopped again. And that's when I got to counter them, and then the gentleman drove on. I was in San Felipe. There, some kind of a cat. I was left alone there, and some kind of a cat. The native said it was an onsa. Now, I'd never heard of an onsa until a year later. I looked into Webster's dictionary, and they have a cat there. It's called an ounce. He's nowhere near as large as a mountain lion, but they say he'll attack a human. Scratch pretty bad. They'll, for instance, get on a tree at a water hole or a spring and wait for an animal to come along. If a man comes along, they will leap on him. And that happened in Sonora to an American who was traveling out that way.
Looks like the tape's almost done.
Well, anyway, I fished there for 17 days, stayed there, and this cat scared the devil out of me for a little bit, but all I had was a machete, a hunting knife, and an axe, pick handle, inside a tent, lots of blankets. I figured, if I get scared, I'll just wrap myself in all these blankets. He just can't scratch through. But if I don't lose my nerve, I'm going to take this machete and a blanket